Good day, Earthlings. It is another episode of the Between the Tackles podcast. I'm Joe, Berger Manish alongside. What's up, boys? We got a loaded episode.
Oh, I'm super pumped for this. Awesome week of football. Awesome episode coming your way here. Can't wait to get into it. Manish, how you doing today, man?
I'm doing great, and I'm looking forward to giving people picks that can't go wrong this week.
Hey, I'm being humble. Later,
but we'll get into that much later, but we do have a great guest.
Yeah, I'm 100%. I'm 100% on locks. If you're looking to tail anybody out there, just tail my lock.
Me too.
Yeah, you're just feasting on the scraps over there. But without further ado, we have Karen Garrigan on the podcast today. We're going to throw it to us on the other side. All right, sports fans, we are here with Karen Garrigan from Mass Live. First of all, thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate it. Two passionate sports fans. So a name that you hear on the post game every week, kind of surreal, kind of sitting here and being with you right now. So I just once again, thank you. Berge, I know you probably want to echo the same thing.
Absolutely. I've been following you for a long time, and I can't thank you enough for taking some time out of your day to come talk with a couple of wacky Patriots fans and our good friend Manish over here.
My good friend Manish too.
Well, Karen, before we get into, you know, the meat and potatoes of, you know, how this season has transpired for New England, I did want to initially talk about a recent ESPN piece, a terrific job by Mike Reese, who covers the Patriots for ESPN, about the dynamics between Mike Vrabel and the media corps, specifically you, really touches on a ritual that Vrabel started back in 2018 with Teresa Walker, who was an AP editor in Tennessee when Vrabel was the Titans head coach. And now he has carried over that tradition by always turning to you for the first question in every press conference. And I've got a lot of thoughts on it, but I just think, you know, in a nutshell, it really speaks to who Vrabel is. But in addition to that, it speaks to the respect that he has and what I think many players throughout the last, you know, 20, 30 years have had for you. So I wanted to ask you initially about what your takeaway was from that piece and what kind of feedback you got, you know, from that story.
Well, the feedback's been all positive. People kind of enjoyed it. And I think Mike enjoyed it too, because he's ribbed me like every day since. You know, he was asking me, how many messages I got and if I was like enjoying my 15 minutes of fame that he gave me and all that. So he likes to kind of have a little fun with people and things like that. But ultimately, you know, it's nice. At first I thought, well, I'm just old, you know, and you know, kind of the Helen Thomas thing, you know, from way back. The way he explained it, at least on the piece, is that he understands that women don't have it quite as easy as others, you know, going back. And again, it is a respect thing. And I wonder if he goes somewhere else, who that will be.
Well, if they keep playing like they're playing, he's not going to go anywhere else anytime soon. You referenced Helen Thomas. And for those who are unfamiliar, Helen Thomas covered the White House beat for the better part of a half a century, 10 presidents. Obviously, because of Bill Belichick, you didn't cover that many coaches. But can you just give us a little background? You know, when did you start covering the Patriots? I know it's been the better part of decades, but you know, when did you start covering them? How did that come about? And I guess perhaps most importantly, why have you decided to stay in such a high profile, high pressure and competitive environment?
Well, I haven't quite caught Helen Thomas yet, but I've been covering sports for 40 years. Out of diapers, by the way, you know, I was like a Doogie Howser of women, you know. But gosh, I go back pre Bill Belichick. I go back to Bill Parcells in covering. So I went through Parcells and Pete Carroll and then Bill Belichick. But, you know, it's been a benefit covering and knowing former Patriots. I mean, Gerard Mayo was the coach last year and Mike Vrabel this year. So I already kind of have a familiarity with them. But I haven't always covered football. I actually started out, I worked at the Boston Herald prior to Mass Live. And, you know, my first real beat there was hockey. I covered the Bruins for a decade or two.
Oh, here we go.
And then, after that, they kind of moved me around. You know, I was kind of, they sent me where all the good stuff was happening. So I was there when the Red Sox finally won the World Series and many more. I was there for the Celtics winning championships. I covered those as well. And the Bruins winning and all of the Patriots winning. I mean, I literally covered Brady cover to cover and Belichick, of course. So, but I know a lot of people who would love my job and would have loved to have been me during the past couple of decades, you know. I do consider myself lucky to kind of have been dropped into the Boston sports scene when I did, because things really started turning around, you know, at different points for all four of the major teams. And I love what I do. That's why I do what I do.
That's awesome. Thank you again, Karen. I mean, I'm hearing you say that you covered the Bruins. I mean, I'm the lone like sole hockey fan. You can probably see right behind me here. I got the Tim Thomas raising the Stanley Cup. I can see in your background, the Bobby Orr flying goal.
Yes.
I think that's awesome. You touched on that. You spent a lot of the different decades covering the Patriots and you went through multiple different regimes. So you kind of outlined the different styles of coaches. I mean, they're all different. What would you say would be like one of the major differences in covering, say, Bill Belichick and Mike Vrabel or Pete Carroll, two different style of coaches, in terms of your interactions with them?
Yeah, well, I think Mike kind of comes in between both a little bit. I think he's in the kind of in the center, but I don't want to say he's closer to Pete Carroll, but I mean, what's important to him is his relationship with the players and how they relate to him and will they buy into what he's selling and will they adhere to the culture that he wants to develop. I mean, I've noticed a lot of like similarities to both Belichick and Parcells. You know, certain things about how, like right away in meetings, Vrabel would quiz players, you know, what did I say yesterday? You know, he would test them, you know, can you repeat what I just said about blah, blah, blah. And he's done it to us too, in the media, you know, what were my goals? But that was something Belichick would do. He would go around the room just to make sure people were listening and not only listening, but grasping what he was saying. And if he had to embarrass someone, he would embarrass him. So I think Mike might have taken that and kind of liked that, and he's adopted it. I mean, if you talk to him, I think he says he's probably, I mean, he's his own man and his own coach, but I mean, he was at Ohio State. He worked with Urban Meyer, I believe. He was coached by Belichick for all those years. He was coached, I don't think it was Andy Reid, but somebody in Kansas City for a couple years. So I think he's kind of taken what he likes from certain coaches and kind of adapted it to him in his own style. But make no mistake, Mike Vrabel is Mike Vrabel, and his style is his style.
Joe, I know Joe's going to jump in with some, you know, X's and O's stuff, but I did want to ask you, Karen, are you surprised, you know, given the benefit of hindsight, we can always say that it was kind of silly that Vrabel didn't get a job last year, but just given how quickly he has reversed course with this franchise, are you surprised that he had to go through his, you know, gap year, for lack of a better phrase, last year as a consultant with Cleveland?
Yeah, I was. I think he talked to some teams. You know, maybe it was more him than them, you know. I think the surprise from New England is, why didn't Robert Kraft just hire him then? Right. But there was language in Gerard Mayo's contract that basically said he would succeed Bill Belichick. The timing wasn't quite what they thought. I mean, I think the Krafts were going to hold on to Bill Belichick until he broke the record, the coaching record. But it just got to a point where they had to cut the cord. And it was a lot faster, you know, maybe 2 or 3 years quicker. And Gerard Mayo had zero experience. He had zero connection, zero contacts. But Robert Kraft loved Gerard Mayo and didn't want to do him dirty by hiring Vrabel. So he kept his word and hired Mayo.
Yeah, so it kind of plays right into like what I wanted to ask about. Now, I saw, obviously, we had some breaking Patriots news. Literally, like, I was sitting down to, like, start up. Start up the podcast, and I have two notifications that Keon White and Kyle Duggar have moved in similar deals, both packaged with a 7th to receive a 6th. Duggar to the Steelers, and then Keon White to the 49ers. So I don't know if you see this more as Vrabel, because you've seen him kind of like release guys like David Andrews, kind of not bring back guys that were captains and leaders of previous teams. Do you see this more in that vein of getting kind of trimming the fat, or do you see this more as maybe positioning for something that might come down the line, like cap-wise?
Well, regarding the getting rid of all the old players, he did extend Marcus Jones for 3 years. Yeah. So that kind of tosses that one out the window a little bit. Although it is true. He has basically thrown out, not say thrown out, but he's basically rid the locker room of many of its past remnants. You know, be it captains, be it anyone with rings. But again, I think he thought that was important in order for him to set the culture that he wants, as opposed to, you know, any tie-in with the past, even though he himself is a tie-in with the past. I just think, you know, he does want his own people. He does want his own players. But like in the case of Keon White and Kyle Duck, Keon White basically just hasn't fit, you know, with the defense. He hasn't done much. I mean, last year he complained about the coaching and not being able to improve because he didn't think the coaching, you know, could get them to improve. So he was frustrated last year. This year at the beginning in training camp, we asked him about the coaching and he was all on board with the coaching, great coaching. And yet he still wasn't able to do much. I mean, he was like a liability on the field. He just did nothing. So that move wasn't a surprise. And the Duggar move, they tried to move Duggar before the deadline and there were no takers. I think Duggar hurt himself last year, actually basically giving one for the team. I mean, he played on a bad ankle all year and his play, it impacted his play, but they didn't have a ton of depth. So he just kept going out there. He had off-season ankle surgery and he came back and it just, he was really slow to come back. Slow in terms of one of the things that made Kyle Duggar so good was his ability to get to the ball or get to the ball carrier. He had a great burst as a tackler. And he didn't quite have that for a while. I mean, he had to play because of injury the last couple of games, and he was okay. But before that ankle injury, he was a standout on defense. He was an impact player. And now he's just kind of an okay player. And Pittsburgh has a huge need, so they were willing to make the deal. San Francisco had a huge need for an edge rusher. They're willing to roll the dice on a second round pick. Both were second round picks.
It's pretty crazy to see that, you know, Duggar just a year and a half ago was like a fixture in the back end for the Patriots. And new coach, a little bit of a new scheme, all new defensive coaches. And the defense this year, you know, albeit against some weak, you know, opposition, and given outside of Buffalo, their schedule has been pretty weak. How, I mean, the defense has exceeded me as a fan, my personal expectations of this, of what I expected. Again, albeit probably a little bit because of the schedule, but seeing that the defense, I mean, still has not allowed a 50-yard rusher to any opponent, which is incredible. I think it's the first time it's happened through this many games in a season. They're doing all of this in the wake of the adversity that they face by not having their defensive coordinator present for most of the season. So I just wanted to get your perspective a little bit as to, you know, what you've seen and how the defense and all the defensive players and coaches have handled, you know, that adversity with Terrell Williams up there.
Yeah, well, I think, I think it helps having your head coach being a defensive guy. It helps having Mike Vrabel. And again, it's his defense. So, and I think mostly, you know, the coaches have kind of rallied around Terrell. And he's still a presence. He's still been around. But, you know, he's just backed off from the responsibility, you know, because he has bigger things to worry mm-hmm. about. And he has treatment that's about to get underway. But I think a lot of the coaches are also, because they've worked with Vrabel and some with Terrell, know the system, you know. So I think, you know, I think that's been helpful. But I am anxious. I mean, they've only really played one good offense, and that being Buffalo. So I'm going to be more curious to see how they do against Tampa, how they do against Buffalo again. I mean, they've played a bunch of either first year, second year, or bum quarterbacks all throughout too. Yeah. So, I still want to see more, although I don't think it's an accident that their current 5-game win streak has coincided with Christian Gonzalez's return because they were giving up all of these huge X plays, as Mike calls them, big plays that they were not tackling well. They weren't playing well in the secondary. And all of a sudden, Christian Gonzalez shows up and it all changes. And again, you had people playing over their weight class to try and make up for Christian Gonzalez not being there. And I think that impacted the whole secondary. So now you have Christian Gonzalez there. You have Carlton Davis on the other side. You have Marcus Jones, who's playing out of his mind at slot corner. You know, the safeties have been okay, not great. You have rookie Craig Woodson and Jalen Hawkins as well. And they're getting, put it this way, they're getting the job done. I need to see more before I'm completely sold on the defense. Although, I mean, their strength is up front. There's no question about that. With Milton Williams, his addition, Kalavon Chaisson has been a surprise as a pass rusher. He's done really well. So that's why they've been great against the run. I still want to see more when they play a better quarterback or better quarterbacks, put it that way.
I think my biggest complaint with the defense, real quick, Joe, before you go on this, is the slow starts. And I think we all have noticed the slow starts with the opening drives where, you know, Cam Ward looks like an elite quarterback just dicing up the defense. And then all of a sudden, right after that, they shut it down. So, you know, I agree with you when it comes to seeing more. When they face like a real quarterback, those slow starts can't happen. They're going to be in trouble if those continue to happen.
Spencer Rattler. I mean, you can just – 6 out of the 8 teams that they've played have scored on the opening drive, be it a field goal or a touchdown. And, you know, they keep talking about, you know, the stuff in the scripts, the opening scripts that, you know, that they're not prepared for. Well, I don't know. I don't know how long you can keep going with that excuse. You know, so we'll see. We'll see. You know, it's funny. Buffalo with Josh Allen is the one team that is one of the two teams that didn't score on the first drive. But Josh Allen scored on just on about every other drive, but not the first one.
Well, I think it's funny that you bring up the script thing. And I was skeptical like you, because I think the point Burge made is I think the slow start isn't just exclusive to the defense. I think that's the more concerning thing. Is just like even the offense looks a little out of sorts on their first drive. So yeah, I don't know if it's a script in general. If whoever's writing the script on offense, if Josh is more of a counterpunch instead of a punch first guy. But what have you seen from McDaniels, the offense, and kind of his play calling to start off the games, and then kind of more of a counterpunch, kind of what Drake May detailed in his post-game comments this week?
Yeah, it's almost like, I don't want to say they're being defensive or they want to see what other teams are doing or trying to do, and then they react to it. But they are smart coaches. So, you know, how Josh handled things to start the second half there. I mean, that first drive why wasn't that the first drive of the game, you know? Right. But again, I think they want to see how things play out. And here's one more thing. I think it was either before the first or second game or whatever, Mike Vrabel talked about wanting to be a good second half team. I mean, one of his emphases was on winning the second half. So maybe that's a little into their mindset or has kind of seeped in a little to the point where, you know, they're willing to sit back and see how things play out. They're willing to kind of get a feel for the game and then basically, you know, all systems go.
I think the DNA, I'll bless you go, Manish, but I think the DNA rubbing off from Vrabel onto this team has been one of the, besides Drake May, obviously becoming like a god amongst men, like the second coming of like Tom Brady with like Josh Allen's running ability, but we'll get to that later. But like the second most exciting thing is the kind of Vrabel being able to form the team after his own identity.
And just touched on this, Joe, and we're like elbow deep in this conversation. We're guilty of, Karen is well aware of this term, we're guilty of burying the lead here. I have no idea why we haven't started talking about Drake May yet in detail. But look, he's been prolific. He's been efficient. The deep ball accuracy is off the charts. I saw something the other day about how only 3 second-year quarterbacks have led the NFL in passer rating through the first 8 weeks of the season. Kurt Warner won the Super Bowl. Ben Roethlisberger won the Super Bowl 20 years ago, and now Drake May this year. I'll just leave it open-ended, Karen. I mean, what is his kryptonite? I mean, can he not see through lead like Superman? Is there a Lois Lane in his life that can distract him? Like, why has he been able to hit the ground running in his second year despite having a new coordinator in Josh McDaniels?
Well, he did just get he got married in the offseason. So.
Oh, okay.
So there's technically a Lois Lane, but she's at the game. So, just to kind of go backwards a little bit, when Josh McDaniels was hired, the big storyline and the big concern around Patriot Nation was, oh my God, so this quarterback is going to have to learn a second offense in 2 years, second coordinator in 2 years. Again, not a recipe for success with quarterbacks. And oh, it's Josh McDaniels' offense. The most complicated, this guy couldn't pick it up. This receiver couldn't pick it up. All these greats couldn't pick it up. And, it's like you had to have a high Mensa score to kind of be able to grasp Josh's offense. So that was all anyone was talking about. And then the first game against the Raiders, Drake May looked lost. I mean, he looked like he didn't know what he was doing. He was thinking too much, trying to do that. It's almost like he had 15 things that he was processing beyond the normal, and he was hesitant, and it was like, oh my God, this is going to be a flipping train wreck. Right? Is there too much on his plate? Is Josh the
knock, right? That was the knock. Yeah. Could he play the college? Right. I mean, could he play the NFL game? And then here comes Josh McDaniels with quite possibly the most complicated off. Yeah, exactly. You could give a kid in the second year.
Yeah. I mean, so again, it buried many receivers because they just couldn't. Again, it involves not just the quarterback, but it involves the receivers because everyone has to know what everyone else is doing. The receivers have to sort of be in the quarterback's mind and know what he's thinking when he sees. It's like they have to see the same thing, okay? As we know, one of Josh McDaniels' quarterbacks was Tom Brady for 20 years. And Tom was like smarter than anybody when it came to that. And he could read defenses quickly. He could process quickly. He could get rid of the ball in 2 seconds. You could have the worst offensive line known to man, but the ball was out before you could blink. And that's why it worked. Could this kid do the same thing? I think something happened between week one and week two. I think, it's like one of those things, kind of seeing how things go. And I think Josh may have figured out some things about the offense. And the other thing to remember is all the offensive coaches on the staff don't come from Josh McDaniels' offense. They're mostly West Coast style offensive coaches. And the good thing about Josh is that during his year off or year and a half off, he was out looking at the college game. He was out looking at other offenses. And he's been able to adapt some West Coast principles to his offense. And in theory, Drake May is more suited to being a quarterback in a West Coast style offense, with the bootlegs and the boot actions and all this stuff. So Josh has married some of those principles and some of those concepts into his offense. And by doing that, it kind of freed up Drake May, or it got him feeling much more comfortable about what he was doing and, you know, what Josh was looking for. And I think once that happened, I think you saw it like in the week two against Miami, that process of suiting the offense or tailoring it more toward Drake's strengths, rolling him out, having him on the move. Now, granted, you don't want to get him killed, you know, but I think they see that Drake May operates at an elite level when he's on the move or in an offense that allows him to move and not just be kind of a drop back pocket passer.
Does he have a tangible weakness? Because it's funny, because you can kind of get lost in, you know, the social media vortex, but it seems like every day there's some statistic that comes up that makes you scratch your head and say, well, I didn't know that about Drake May. I just saw something the other day. You know, the Falcons are up next. Jeff Ulbrich, their defense coordinator, has really turned around their defense. They primarily play cover one, single high safety, about three quarters of the time, most in the NFL in the last 4 years. So you wonder, well, how good is Drake May against single high safety? Looks, well, he leads the NFL in passing against single high safety. He leads the NFL in yards per attempt. And because of his athleticism, he leads the NFL in scrambles against a single high safety. So it almost seems like this guy is too good to be true. Nobody's going to be Tom Brady, but he does have a great head on his shoulders from the outside looking in. The things he says about studying Brady's work habits and listening to his Hall of Fame speech, making sure that he tells everybody he doesn't want to be the greatest of all time. He just wants to get better. From your perspective, dealing with him in a way that the average fan obviously doesn't get to see, what particularly impresses you about his makeup when you talk to him, whether it's privately or, you know, in those moments where you're not really interviewing him and just kind of learning about him as a person?
Well, it's like he's very easygoing, kind of an aw shucks, in an aw shucks kind of way. And I think, but beneath it, beneath that kind of happy-go-lucky Drake May exterior is a really competitive, he has a huge competitive fire. And I think a lot of that came from being in a family of four boys and being the youngest and always having to fight and compete and always having to, you know, try and outdo his brothers. And that's kind of stuck with him. He's competitive as all get out. And you wouldn't, and again, that was another Brady trait. But Brady was a little more obvious about it. I think Drake is a little more subtle about it. Because if you talk to guys who are in a card game with him or, you know, ping pong or something, they talk about, God, he just wants to beat you, you know, or they talk about his competitiveness even outside of football. So I think that's kind of part of his secret sauce. But you're right. No matter what anyone defensive coordinator has thrown at him, he's been able to handle and or adjust. I mean, he had Myles Garrett in his earlobe. every drop back or every passing play, but again they fixed that. They rolled him right away from him, you know, or they just did things to get him away from Myles Garrett. But again, he was like undaunted. If I'm getting sacked six times, I might, be a little hesitant. No, not this kid.
I was hesitant on my couch, like every time he dropped back to pass, and he was the one actually getting hit.
I love hearing that competitive nature, though. That competitive nature, you think about like Tom Brady, and not trying to draw comparisons to Tom Brady, hear about that.
But there are some similarities like that, and the one thing, Drake, in watching film of Brady, the one thing that he took away that I think has resonated with him, in watching Brady, he was so impressed by how quick. It's like Brady knew what he was going to do before even getting under center. Just by looking out, Brady knew right away. And I think it really impressed Drake, again, how quick Brady was in making a decision where to go. And two, how quickly he got rid of the ball. And I think, again, that sits in his head saying, again, Josh's offense, that's what helps make Josh's offense go. Quick decisions, quick, passing, blah, blah, blah. So I think he's done his best to adapt that as well.
Exactly. And, I love hearing Manish starting to come around on it too. Joe and I have been working on him for about 8 weeks now on Drake May.
These guys had him as the next Brady a month ago. So they had pumped the break.
I said somewhere below Mahomes as a second-year player.
There's only one Brady. End of story.
I agree. At least we can all agree on that one.
And they're two different. It's two different styles, So, Brady, yeah, he deked Brian Urlacher once, but, but he was slow as well. And the last thing you wanted him to do was to go out and start running. Drake is the basically the prototype of the modern quarterback. And he has, between his stature, his rocket arm, his ability to use his legs, his fearlessness, and that might be the kryptonite right there.
Yeah.
Because he hasn't figured out gaining that extra yard, it's just not worth it. It's almost like going back to that competitiveness. It's like an internal fight with him to say, go down. Because I asked him about this last week. I said, does it kind of go against your temperament and your, to just go down? He goes, yeah, it does. But then he said, well, after you get hit a couple times, then it starts to click, go down.
Yeah, seeing his head go off the turf, it makes you cringe every time. I think back to, when Brady would get sacked, and I think to the Elvis Dumervilleville hit that he took when he got planted in Denver. And I'm like, it just makes you cringe sitting on your couch thinking about that. Yeah. And I don't want to see Drake go through that. Speaking again on what Drake May has done with the offense, this wide receiver group has also really stepped up. And to me, it's the biggest surprise of this season outside of Drake May's, rapid development, and seeing what a guy like Kayshon Boutte is doing with Drake May. And I was one in the offseason thinking Stephon Diggs wasn't going to be enough to help him in his second year. They didn't do enough to improve the offense to help him. And boy, like Kayshon Boutte has shut me right up. He's been incredible.
Yeah, he's really taken a leap. It's funny, his first year with Belichick, he didn't get – it was the first game of the year. He didn't get 2 feet in bounds, and then you didn't hear from him again. Mm-hmm. That was the end of him. He was in the doghouse for kind of the rest of the year. They lost that game. You saw signs of it last year of, Boutte, his potential. I mean, he was good at contested catches and deep balls. He's not the fastest guy, but he gets open. And he's developed a really nice chemistry with Drake May, particularly on those deep balls. But getting back to Diggs, again, another question mark coming back from ACL surgery, his rapid recovery. He didn't look great in his first few games. He looked slow, if you ask me. Then they play Buffalo, and all of a sudden he comes alive, his old team. And but he's been that in every game since. And the fact that he did what he did against the Bills, what was it, 10 catches, a buck 40 or whatever it was, it put other teams on notice. Hey, we might have to pay attention to this guy. And any attention you can get away from everybody else is going to help those guys, because it's not, their receivers aren't great at beating man coverage, but they do have receivers who are kind of slick in terms of getting open. Mm-hmm. But having Diggs's presence has really opened up lanes for everybody else. And we've seen it.
I hate to cut the Kayshon Booty love fest short, but along these lines, Karen, I don't think anything's going to happen before the trade deadline just because of the financial ramifications. But do you see a world where the Patriots do make a legitimate offer for a disgruntled wide receiver that Mike Vrabel has an affinity for, and that's A.J. Brown? Obviously, the Eagles are trying to go back-to-back. I wouldn't anticipate any kind of movement over the next week. But in the offseason, if he were legitimately available and you would know that it would take a fair amount of compensation to get him back do you think Mike Vrabel would try to get him back in earnest?
I definitely think they would kick the tires. I definitely think that they would be an interest there. I mean, Mike, there's quite a few players currently on the team that have played that are Mike Vrabel players at one point or another. And here's the other part. Again, it would seem that Vrabel and A.J. Brown have a good connection, but is he going to be a culture fit? I think that's the other biggest part of the equation in terms of who they bring in or who they don't bring in. And I wasn't sure Stefon Diggs was going to be a culture fit, but he's bought in. He is totally bought in. He loves the Vrabel way. You know, he's playing ball right now. He's being a good teammate, a great teammate, actually. So I think if Vrabel knows that whoever they bring in won't disrupt what they have going, sure, he'll bring them in.
Do you think any of the other wide receivers that have been whispered and spoken about are more realistic at the deadline or at any point in the future?
It's funny. I wrote today that, you know, you would think, like, for years upon years, we've been screaming, they need an elite receiver. They need help. They need a one. They need a two. They need blah, 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 blah. But given how things have turned out, you know, when it comes to a list of needs, wide receiver has gone from the top down a few rungs. They have more important needs. You know, they need another edge rusher. They just traded one away because they need someone basically to be him. You know, I mean, they have their two starters with Landry and Chase on. If one of them gets hurt, they have nobody. So I would think that's a priority. I still think running back will be a priority, depending on who they might be able to get. And they don't have depth in a lot of places. Again, one injury could derail the whole enchilada. So I think, again, receiver has gone from the top to maybe down to the middle in terms of needs. I don't see them going after a receiver before the deadline.
Karen, I can't thank you enough for coming on. Your institutional knowledge of the Patriots is second to none. you know, getting into the weeds of this team has been really enjoyable. I do want to say a couple things for us, for all the great things that Karen brings to the table. There's one thing that she's really been awful at, and I just have to say it now, a terrible self-promoter. So what I am going to say is, first and foremost, read Karen's Patriots coverage on masslive.com. She has a good piece this week about how the external expectations of the Patriots, now that they're off to a hot start, compared to what the internal expectations are among the players. I've always found that interesting because, you know, for all the hype that comes on a team that's suddenly on a roll, you really want to get a gauge of, you know, what's happening inside the locker room. So I would encourage that and the remainder of the season on Twitter or X, whatever it's called now. Kay Garrigan is her follow. And one final note, this past year, Mary Kay Cabot won the Bill Nunn Award, which is the award given to the writer who goes into the Pro Football Hall of Fame writer's wing. And Mary Kay is a good friend of mine. She's covered the Cleveland Browns for, you know, as long as I've, you know, been in media. She does a terrific job. I believe she is the second woman after Shireen Williams, who covered the Cowboys for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, to be in the writer's wing of the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And just so the listeners know, the Pro Football Writers Association typically nominates, you know, three or four people each year, you know, so that the members can vote on who the newest addition to the Hall of Fame will be. So I know it's long overdue. I'm very hopeful that Karen gets an opportunity to be nominated, and that'll be the first step toward getting into a place where she absolutely has earned and deserved being part of the Patriots dynasty coverage, and doing it in a way that she has is second to none. As much as I loved the ESPN piece on Mike Vrabel, what I especially liked was after the piece, Teddy Bruschi, who was an ESPN analyst, said that everybody loves Karen and nobody is trusted more by the players through the years than Karen is. So the award goes to someone who has covered professional football in a long and distinguished manner. And I think that perfectly encapsulates what Karen's coverage of the Patriots has been. So I'm really hopeful that, you know, people in the Pro Football Writers Association nominate you, and that ultimately leads to a path to Canton, because, you know, it's something, again, that you have earned. You are not a self-promoter, and that's your Achilles heel. But I hope that, you know, given her, your incredible body of work and, you know, some of this more recent acclaim that you've gotten, that it ultimately leads to a path to being a member of the Hall of Fame.
Thank you, Manish. I'm not going to add on to that because I am not a self-promoter. But I do appreciate it. As I said, I love what I do. I enjoy my work. That's why I've been at it almost as long as Helen Thomas.
Well, you know, they called Helen Thomas a sitting Buddha. So I'm wondering, do Reese and Curran and those guys call you the sitting Buddha?
No. Don't give them any ideas.
The first lady of the press. Do they call you that?
No. Don't give them ideas. Come on now.
Maybe I'll text them and give them an idea. Yeah, Karen, we really appreciate your time. Great information. And as always, you know, good luck to potentially covering another dynasty. I can't believe I'm saying that, but, at least a deep playoff run this year.
You'll have to have me on again then. How's that?
Of course.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That works. Karen, I just want to also say, just from my perspective, I really appreciate you taking again time to come out and talk to a couple of wacky fans here. You kind of checked me a little bit with where my take on the team is. I'm like the massive homer over here, and I appreciate you taking me down a notch to make me a little bit more realistic. So again, thank you very much for taking the time. We'll definitely have you back on again.
Yeah, I can't thank you enough. I remember being in the back of like college lectures, like trying to like goof off and like reading like your stuff on the Patriots, like during like the second half of the run, and like being like, are we ever gonna like the dreaded 10 years in the middle when we were only going to AFC Championship games? I was like, are we ever gonna do it again? Do I ever taste that sweet victory like I did when I was a child? So it's very surreal having you on the podcast. So thank you very much for your time. I hope you find some time to do it again.
I sure will. Thank you.
All right, we are back off a awesome interview with Karen Garrigan of Mass Live. Burge and I were just talking a little behind the scenes. We were basically like, we were a little starstruck because like it's somebody we've heard in our living room TV, on our living room TVs, and in our car radio since we were like whatever, since we started kids watching the Patriots. Yeah, kids. So that was pretty cool. Pretty sure you felt the same way. But anyway, Burge, I'll throw you right off to the top. We're going to keep it nip and tuck here on the back nine. Picks last week, how'd we do?
It was a tough week. Tough week for the between the tackles picks. Except for me. That's the only brag I'm going to throw in there. I was 2-1 with the scraps. Joe, you were 1-2. I beat you in our head-to-head pick. And Manish had the 0-3. Oh, God. 0-3 record. Embarrassing. Real quick, just a quick recap of the overall standings. Manish, 8-15-1. Joe,
is that a real record? 8-15-1?
8-15-1.
8-15-1. Oh my Joe, God. Joe's not much better at 10-14. And I'm 13-11. So we're all not doing all that hot.
Oh, 13-11 is really good, Burge. Can I propose a rule change? We could talk about this off air. I just think it'd be fun banter. But proposing a rule change. Even though Manish is first to chime in at midnight on Monday morning, and he still goes 0-3, I think we should put out there like you get one pick at a time. Like you put out a pick, and then everybody gets a pick, and then you get your second pick, and then kind of do like a round robin like that instead of being like, all right, I get the three best lines like right off the top, like fucking.
But were they the three best lines if I lost all three?
Every time the best part is you've gone into the group message the last 2 weeks and gone 0-6, and every single time I'm like, God damn it, he got all the good ones, and he went 0-6.
No, hold on. I lost three 2 weeks ago, and then this week in between. Okay. I scrapped out a win in between.
So, what's that? 8-1.
Get right. Let's get right.
1-8 in your last 3 weeks. I would put it 2-7. All of your picks. I would parlay all of your picks this week and put the house on it because I guarantee.
When I said you can make money with my picks, that's actually true if you just do the opposite. If you Costanza it.
Fade. You know? Yeah, he's definitely fade. Who do you got this week?
All right. My first pick, I have Kansas City -1.5 against the Buffalo Bills in Orchard Park. Kansas City, hater pick. It's partially a hater pick, but Kansas City, we were talking at halftime last night being like, oh, those Mahomes takes were pretty bad. And they come out, they end up walloping the Commanders in the second half, holding them scoreless and winning 28-7. Buffalo losing Ed Oliver. We were talking a little bit off air with Karen about that. Their defense has been a little suspect this year, and just add in their best pass rusher on the defensive front. Losing him indefinitely is a huge loss for the Buffalo Bills. And I know the history says that the Bills own Kansas City in the regular season, and it's the opposite in the playoffs, but I like Kansas City. They're rolling. We've been watching them for a while now. So I think that they're going to get over that hump and beat the Bills on the road in Orchard Park. My second pick, I have the Carolina Panthers +12.5 against the Green Bay Packers. We'll talk about the Packers here in a few minutes. I don't think Carolina's going to win this game. That number's too large for me to give up here. It worked out well for me with the Buffalo and the Saints game earlier in the season, so I'm going to ride with it again. I don't care who the quarterback is, whether it's Bryce Young or Andy Dalton. I like the points there. And my lock of the week, I have the Indianapolis Colts. They're -3 on the road against the Steelers. Went well for me picking against the Steelers this past week against Green Bay. I really don't respect the Steelers defense, even though they just added quote unquote superstar Kyle Duggar from the New England Patriots. Don't care. I think their defense is fraudulent. Rodgers does look like a 41-year-old quarterback. He's not as mobile. And I think that is a real detriment to what the Steelers are trying to do. And Indianapolis, again, I've said it before, I'm kind of sticking with them until they show me a crack. They've been offensively, Jonathan Taylor should be a front-running MVP candidate with the way that he's played this year, coming off a monster game. And I like them to continue it against what I think is a fraudulent defense in Pittsburgh. So Indianapolis minus -3 is my lock of the week. Joe?
All right, I'll work backwards here towards my lock, just like Burge did. I'm going to take Baltimore minus -8.5 in Miami on Thursday night. I think Lamar Jackson's going to play in this game. He's got a long time off. Baltimore won with Tyler Snoop Huntley on Sunday, and I think they're going to be pumped up with Lamar coming back on a short week in Miami. I think they got a burst saying that the owner saying that they're not going to be firing the coach there. And won this week, Miami did, but I think that'll be short-lived. I think Miami, Baltimore uses as a get-right game. Their second one in a row, but the first one for Lamar Jackson. The next one, dude, these are the slimmest of bare-bones pickings. If these go 3-0, this is insane.
He did pick last for disclosure. He did pick last this week.
So I'm gonna take the Commanders plus +3.5 at home versus Seattle. This is the Sunday night game. I don't think Jaden Daniels is going to play in this game, but I'm basically just – this is an anti-Sam Darnold pick. This is finally turned into a pumpkin and on Sunday night where he was singing Ghosts last time we saw him in New England. Like we said, I was third to pick, and this is so bad that I went from – who do I think is going to win or who do I think is going to cover? It went to who do I think might absolutely suck? And I think the Seahawks and Sam Darnold are due, more than due. And for my mortal epic lock of the century, after my mortal epic lock of the millennia that I had last week, my mortal epic lock of the century, the take my mama and throw away the key if it don't hit lock of the century, give me New England Patriots minus -5.5 at home versus Atlanta. Who's going to play quarterback for Atlanta? I don't know. The Patriots start slow. I don't really give a damn. They're going to rip the head off that Falcon and it just absolutely cannibalize the Atlanta Falcons. They find that the Patriots finally got the run game going. Atlanta does have a formidable defense, but you saw Drake May and Josh. I almost called Drake Josh McDaniels Josh Allen, but you saw Drake May and Josh McDaniels kind of scheme away from all the strengths of Cleveland, and I think that they'll have the ability to do that again. So give me New England minus -5.5 at home versus Atlanta as my lock of the week. Manish, what do you got?
Well, I'm going back to the Cowboys. Well, after they screwed me by getting torched in Denver last week, they are home this week. A different team at home, 1-4 away from AT&T Stadium, undefeated, 2-0-1 with that 40-40 tie against the Packers at home. They're playing at home, primetime Sunday night against the Cardinals team that absolutely stinks. They've lost 5 in a row, coming off a bye. I don't think it matters. Cowboys win. I think the Cowboys, despite having a Pee Wee League level defense, will win this game and rather comfortably. Second game, I'm going back to the well again and picking against the Texans after getting screwed last week after they beat the 49ers. I do not think the Texans are going to beat the Denver Broncos. The Broncos are 1.5-point underdogs on the road. Denver's won 5 in a row, I believe, rounding into form. Not still the huge... the biggest Bo Nix fan, but I still can't believe the Texans can win games consistently behind that offensive line. I know C.J. Stroud has played much better for the most part over the last several weeks. Just not a believer in the Texans, not at all. Still a believer in Sean Payton. 5 in a row, you can say what you want. One of those 5 wins, maybe a gift from the Giants a couple weeks ago. Nevertheless, 5 in a row is 5 in a row. They're going to make it 6 in a row as a 1.5-point road dog. And then my best bet, my lock of the week, you can take this to the bank. I don't know what bank, but you can take it to the bank. I'm going back to the Niners well after getting kind of pinched last week, having them lose to the Texans after I believe I said that was the worst line imaginable for the week. Obviously, the odds makers were right, and I wasn't. But the Niners are 2.5-point favorites on the road against the Cam Scadabo-less New York Giants. So I'm going to go with the Niners to bounce back from that loss against the Texans. The Giants coming off getting killed in Philadelphia. I just don't think they have the punch. They're 2-6. It was a nice story for a few weeks. I do think Tyrone Tracy is your fantasy super start of the week. I know we're not doing that technically this week, but Tyrone Tracy is going to get the lion's share of the backfield work now that Cam is out for the year. I just don't think the Giants really have a chance against a Niners team that's probably ticked off after that loss. And one final caveat, not really related to this game, but related to the Giants, a tip of the cap to the great Philadelphia Eagles fans who gave Cam Scatabo a standing ovation as he was carted off after that gruesome ankle injury last week. And in addition to that, Big Dom, everybody knows Big Dom, went to the hospital. I believe he gave cheesesteaks to Cam Scatabo while he was, on the mend. Really a classy place, you know, for all the critical coverage of Philadelphia sports fans. I really thought, in my admittedly biased opinion, that a really nice gesture by the Eagles fans to give Scatabo, a little bit of warm wishes in a an unfortunate moment for him.
Yeah, Philadelphia, notoriously classy and respectful fans. Anyway, I thought that was cool. The Big Dom part was cool. His mystique, he's just like, I just like how he's one of those guys that just like stayed mysterious instead of like jumped all over his like 15 minutes of fame. He was just like, no, you guys can have all like one on Pardon My Take one time. And he just kind of just like lurks on the sidelines and just,
yeah. Now this is what I'll say about Cam. I don't want to go off on a big tangent, but it's they reclassified his job title, so he could be on the sideline, after that incident with the Niners player. But he wears a headset during the game. To this day, I have no idea why he would require a headset during the game. I don't know if he's listening to the calls, but that to me is the funniest thing. But like from everyone who knows Dom, really salt of the earth guy, good guy. But I think it's funny that he's got a headset on. Really don't quite understand why that is.
Yeah, I just want to make it abundantly clear for everybody listening that this is a pro Big Dom podcast in every way possible. And if this gets back to him, we are nothing but a fan, sir. Anyway, let's wrap it up with our top five power rankings. Nothing changing in the top three. Lions 1, Rams 2, both on a bye. Colts 3. And then we'll get to 4, the Packers. Burge, talk to me.
Yeah, we had the Packers move up from one slot. They were in the 5 slot last week. The Packers are coming off that big win on Sunday night against the Pittsburgh Steelers. My lock of the week that nicely hit. Their team, that division up there, the NFC North, with the Lions, is going to be a fantastic battle to watch down the stretch. Jordan Love and that offense is rolling. I've always been a big fan of Matt LaFleur, and let's not forget what they're doing on defense. They have Micah Parsons down there, who's having a year again, doing basically what they expected when they gave up all that capital to bring him in. And it was just a legitimate win against a team that, a lot of people were high on this year. Not me. I was ahead of that one. But the Packers are a team that are going to be very scary down the stretch for any opponent that they play. They got a big matchup in a couple of weeks against the Philadelphia Eagles at Lambeau that will be a real measuring stick for where this Green Bay Packers is at. So they deservedly move up one spot. And Manish, our fifth team here is nipping right at their heels to catch them.
Yeah, well, we've got a new member of the top five, but a familiar team for anyone who follows football, and that's the Kansas City Chiefs. And we've been discussing them the last couple of weeks. They've been kind of rounding into shape. You saw that the other night, kind of sloppy first half against the Washington Commanders. And then Patrick Mahomes took over, 3 touchdowns in the second half, blowout win. The Chiefs are really embarking on an interesting 3-game stretch. Over the next month, we're going to learn a lot about whether these are the Chiefs that we remember or maybe a team that's, kind of faltering, because that's what we thought at the beginning of the season. They're not the same old Chiefs. Now we're looking at them as they are the same old Chiefs. Well, they got the Bills this week. They got a bye after that, and then right after the bye, back-to-back, Denver, Indianapolis. You're talking about three of the best teams in the conference over the next month. We're going to learn a lot more about Kansas City. But from what I've seen over the last couple of weeks, this looks like a team to be reckoned with. And potentially, you know, despite not having the best record in the conference, I think the Chiefs are the best team in the conference.
Yeah, and I think they just took the Bucs out of the top five, and we put the Chiefs in. I mean, the Bucs with a respectable win over an inferior opponent, but I just think that when you look at the body of work from the Chiefs the last month versus the Bucs the last month, I don't think they're comparable, especially when you have the Chiefs win over the Lions thrown in there. I don't think the Bucs have a win like that this year on their schedule. So
can't
other
forget
teams
forget about the Bucs injuries that they've faced this year too. I mean, the whole offense has been just decimated by those injuries. So it's hard for a team to really come back from that.
And they're going in that direction. And the Chiefs are getting people back, you know what I mean, from injury and suspension and felonious activities and whatnot.
felonious?
Yeah, I don't even think that's a shout out, Kojak, if you're listening. But honorable mention, we had the Bucks, like we just talked about, the Broncos, the Eagles, Manish, the Eagles. I think they're going to keep trucking along. I think this is going to be one of those seasons where they're going to be extremely underwhelming, and then when you try to play them in the playoffs, they're going to be impossible to beat, especially if they're on the field.
Look, just like the Chiefs, the Eagles are on a bye this week, but coming off the bye, Packers and Lions, we're going to learn a lot about Philadelphia right after the bye. Find out if, again, are they legitimate, repeat contenders, or are they just going to be a playoff team that gets bounced early?
And Birch, can I get a gosh darn drum roll, please? The last team in our honorable mention, we said they were challenging for a top 10 spot last week. I think they put an emphatic stamp on their win by beating one of the best defenses in football, dropping over 30 points on them, the New England Patriots. I honestly think that we're a couple weeks away. If the Patriots beat the Bucs, they take care of business against Atlanta and then beat the Bucs. I mean, I don't know. I mean, if they beat Atlanta and any of these other teams like lose, I mean, there's really not a better case for any other team. The Eagles, Broncos, Bucs. I don't really know. I don't know. I'm just getting pumped about the Patriots.
Crisco.
That was like one of those. It was like one of those Michael Scott sentences. Like, I don't know where I'm going. I'm just fucking amped about the Pats, dude.
Yeah, dude. I mean, it's hard not to be. I mean, it was nice to hear Manish bring up in the interview with Karen about like why not the Patriots. To some sentiment, he brought that up in the interview, and I'm like, I said
you were
that 2 weeks ago.
Part of the Crisco boys in that interview, dude.
I think you guys were just a little premature in waxing poetic. But look, every week, and you guys have said this to your credit. You can't control your schedule. You can't control how you're playing. Now, you know, it wasn't a laugher against the Saints, but last week against Cleveland, a clearly inferior team, despite having a great defense, they handled business. And Karen mentioned it earlier. What was especially impressive about Drake May was that it's not like he had a clean pocket all day. The guy was getting, you know, hit a lot, and hit a lot by arguably the best player in the NFL from a defensive perspective in Myles Garrett. And we didn't talk about this with Karen, but what I thought was eye-opening was after the game, the praise that Myles Garrett had for Drake May. You don't typically hear that. You might give a cursory, yeah, this guy's good or he's okay. But Myles Garrett really kind of, you know, went deep into why he thinks Drake May is going to be a really good player. And I think, you know, what you have the respect, a second-year quarterback has the respect of a player of Myles Garrett's ilk. That says a lot about, what these opponents think about this quarterback.
If anybody else loves reading between the lines like I do, I don't know if you could help but read between the lines when he was talking about Drake May that just basically said, please effing get me out of here and trade for me. He's like, That's exactly what I was thinking. I will live in the lighthouse is what he was saying. He's like, please let me live in the giant schmens in the north end zone. Please, dude. That's what he was saying in between the lines. But do you guys have anything else to add? A week nine coming up here. Any other thoughts, predictions, anything you want to get off your chest?
I'm just looking forward to all of these great matchups that we're going to get over the next couple of weeks. There are some really good matchups in the NFL that we're really going to find out about those teams.
Friggin' six teams on a bye this week.
So that's the nature of the beast.
Yeah. And it is a beast. So that was us. That was the Between the Tackles podcast. yeah, follow us on all socials. Find us on Twitter. Find us on Instagram. Find us on YouTube. Throw us a subscribe on YouTube. We're putting those shorts out daily. So if you don't have time to get to the entire podcast right off the rip, you can see all of our best takes and just a lot of clips of me in a bucket hat for some reason. But anyway, that was Between the Tackles. I'm Joe. That's Burge. Manish, Karen, thanks for coming on. We'll catch you guys next week. Goodbye.
Peace.